thank you for taking time to listen to today's episode. As I'm sure you know, the current crisis in Myanmar is extremely concerning, and we appreciate that you're taking the time to stay informed. There's even value in just becoming a little more aware and helping to inform others. So we would like to encourage you to please consider sharing this episode so that more people may learn about what is really happening in the country now. It's just absolutely critical to ensure that this issue remains present in public discourse everywhere. But now let's get on to the interview itself. We are speaking from The Hague at ISS, the International Institute of Social Studies, to have this conversation. And we're going to be exploring the extractive industries in Burma as it relates to climate change and as that relates to so much of Myanmar's past and current political strife and current resistance movement, both looking at past examples as well as how it's manifesting today in the current revolution. So with that, I thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
Oh, thank you, Joel, for having me.
So let's get into your background of this research and as you suggested in tracing this history, let's start back a bit before with what you found and show how that then leads and is relevant to what we're seeing today.
Right. So so currently, I focus on research focused on research that's mostly relevant for climate resilience. How do we support climate capacity, climate action, and climate resilient development in conflict affected and fragile states? And I really look at the Myanmar as the most interesting and important case, and try to highlight this intersectional issues in Myanmar, which is now in a very much of a very conflict affected context. But before I embarked this research, I was mostly working on community resistance against dams in Myanmar. So that's a little bit of a background of about me. This was my PhD research. I did field work in Myanmar, focusing on communities that were facing hydropower dam-related displacement and negative impact on their livelihoods in Karen and Kachin, and also to an extent in Northern Shan State. And in Myanmar, as you know, this hydropower potential is very promising. At least that's what the numbers say, that they have more than 100 sites that can be suitable for large-scale hydropower development. And most of these sites are located in ethnic minority area that are basically currently in very heavily conflict-affected settings. So all these sites are also home to ethnic minorities. So I studied mostly the Kachin and Karen community and also the Ta'an community for my smaller case study. But yeah, basically there are any ethnic minority groups that you will look at in Myanmar, they have something about like them being affected by hydropower dams. So this is sort of this historical environmental justice issue in Myanmar, that these communities were disproportionately affected by this renewable energy development. Now we think about renewable energy as something very good, a very important piece of our green and just transition from this fossil fuel-based economy to more of this green economy that's less harmful to the environment and to the climate. But we think about this environmental justice issue, just for this example of the hydropower, you can see that, yeah, this development projects, or development, maybe I should have an air quote, in development projects, or this type of extractive industry, because also hydropower has this extractive aspect, they have, they are just fundamentally not considering this local impact, both environmental and social impact. So we need to really think about, so is this the way that needs to be go forward? So that's a bit of a background that I come from. So I've been looking at this environmental justice, grassroots resistance to large-scale infrastructure projects. So just the before we think about the coup and this current struggles, this political and humanitarian crisis, so I know for a fact that Myanmar's communities and the many of these very capable activists have organized resistance against these projects, against the military during the previous dictatorship under very difficult circumstances. Mm. And I was very impressed by how they mobilized the community. And a lot of these homegrown movements were largely unknown to the world, but then later it became known also because of the local activists were publishing in English and doing more community-based research, participatory research. So this became known to us. And there is a lot of like resilience there that I found, that people care for each other, care for the environment in all these difficult circumstances. So that was just personally very moving, and that really gave me the motivation to complete my own research on this topic.
Can you give some examples on that?
Yeah, so maybe this case of the Mitsun Dam in Kachin State is probably one of the most well-known case of hydropower projects in Myanmar. So this project was first planned in 2003-2004, the collaboration between the Chinese investors, back then it was China Power Investment, and the previous junta. So this was a very high-level cooperation that China will bring this project to Myanmar, like sort of framed as a gift, and the all the project planning and sort of the preparatory work was done without anyone's notice for the people who are living in Kachin State. Mm-hmm. So when people found out, actually completely by accident, because they just found a booklet about this project in a tea shop that was left by some Japanese engineers.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so they accidentally found out about this project, and then they translated and they found that, yeah, there will be a dam built in this confluence area. That's basically the headwater of the Irrawaddy River. Mm. But then some of the local population didn't even believe that such scale of infrastructure can be constructed, because for them, confluence is very big. This is where they go for picnics, and also local culture consider this space as a very culturally important ritual site. So they just didn't even expect that this will be possible. Actually, I heard this quite many times when I talked to the local people about dam projects. They were like, yeah, I mean, nothing can stop the Salween River from flowing and giving us giving us what we need. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a interesting example of also understanding the impact of this infrastructure. It might be difficult for some people, but once this damage is also done, it is very difficult to reverse. So in many ways, bringing this shared understanding was a big part of the community mobilization that activists had to do. And this case of the Mitsun Dam, it's not only that the Kachin community managed to resist, but also that connection, this network of the Kachin activists and also the Myanmar activists were based in Yangon and Mandalay, was very effective in terms of the alliance, and they became very successful and led to a nationwide protest for saving the Irrawaddy.
That's kind of an amazing story in and of itself, that a Japanese engineer accidentally leaving behind information about this dam project, which local people find, and I assume in some village setting, then that starting from there, that extends to regional, national, and even international attention and protests, which then effectively mobilizes to stop this major top-level deal from taking place. Can you tell us more information about how this resistance was able to be organized to make this possible?
Yeah, right. I mean, thanks for also the pointing out this important connection. Because now, because of the Mison suspension, the Chinese government and also the Chinese companies really take more attention to the local dynamics. So mm-hmm. I think this has become a sort of study example for the Chinese investors who are going overseas to understand the local dynamics, and maybe don't engage with the conflict actors so directly, etc. And just to to build the local also trust. I think this was a really has become an important also as the important element in Chinese investment during recent years. You can see this also in the Belt and Road Initiative, that how they engage with the local population has changed after the Mison. That this also had this event had a major impact. I think on the national scale, I mean, it's really the. So I initially thought these two movements were very different. Mm-hmm. So the resistance at the local level and the national campaign. So these were two separate social movements. So I treated it that way at the beginning. And I also do think that there are two separate narratives. One is more about the local livelihood, local people's justice for the environment, and how they want to have their land that had been in the family for a couple of generations. But I think for the Myanmar, it's more about this, thinking about the Irrawaddy River as something very integral to Myanmar. It's a mother. It is the mother of the country, and it does cross all the major cities. So I mean, I think in that way, yes, they have different narratives and different reasons why they resisted. But I think there is definitely some sort of a meeting point between these two movements, which I think now we see more in this current revolutionary politics, that because of this indiscriminate and brutal violence of the junta really changed people's perspective about, so this violence happened in periphery of the country is not really separating me from the people who are victimized mm-hmm. over the years. So there is definitely more connection. I think it's kind of the victimhood that's connecting people who are who identify as ethnic minority and who do not. So, in that way, there are many of this kind of connections are made more clear. But I think back then it was the cultural connection, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the Kachin activists also realized, yes, the Irrawaddy River is also important for the Burmese culture and the historical narrative, and also in kind of this emotional feelings about people, how they relate to the environment, how they think about the flood, and how they think about the river. So, and in that way, they really managed they managed to unlock some certain emotional cue from the general public. I think that's the reason why it became so big. And I think you talk to also many artists and the poets. And I think there are also poems and the photography exhibitions was set on the Irrawaddy, and because it's about the saving the Irrawaddy, right? So saving the Irrawaddy from the extraction. So in a way, this was a little bit broader than just resisting one dam, which I think it was a very excellent framing from the social movement perspective as well. So these activists were very effective. And then it also resonated with also some of this anti-Chinese sentiment, because the main investor was the Chinese company, and we know that the friendship between the China and the military junta, it can be a little bit ambivalent, and it's a bit obscure. But mm-hmm. before, it was definitely very strong, that China was the only guarantor of the junta, well, I guess there were some other countries, like I guess Russia always had some connections with the junta, but I mean, the strong connection was the Chinese. So I think that also sparked a lot of the negative sentiment, which was also helpful to mobilize. So I think in that way, we also, that was also the after the Saffron Revolution. Mm-hmm. So Myanmar always had this tradition of large-scale uprising. And I think mm-hmm. that's also helpful, again, to mobilize for some kind of important cause, which was the Mae-Sone Dam and the saving the Irrawaddy River.
Mm. It seems like there are just several threads wrapped inside this resistance movement. And I've heard it characterized predominantly by focusing on one at the expense of the other threads, but they're all in there. I mean, you have the environmental resistance, you have the ethnic causes, you have the anti-Chinese, you have the pro-civil society, democracy, human rights angle. And it seems like there's these different threads of meaning that came to characterize the success of the surprising success of this effort. And I suppose you could look at it from, you could approach it from these different angles and see it as anything from, you know, like the rights of ethnics to, you know, predominantly something protecting the environment to the civil society democracy. And you can come at it from these different angles because all of these things were integrated in there.
I mean, that's definitely true. And I think that is so relevant for this current resistance, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, from the social movement perspective, I think the most successful movements have always the very broad framing. Mm. So everyone can have a piece of mm-hmm. this, and a lot of the ideas can survive in this very big roof. So in that way, this Spring Revolution and the, especially the large-scale uprising has so much potential for the future politics of Myanmar. And then another thing that I wanted to talk about today was this climate change and what do we do about it. And I really believe that climate change, focusing on the more of the aspects of climate justice, it can become part of this resistance movement. And I think it should be part of the resistance movement, although people have limited resources just to focus on the humanitarian needs, mm-hmm. Conflict situation, just helping the day-to-day life of everyone. I fully understand this is really tough time for everyone. And I'm not saying that climate change should be part of the agenda or part of the talk or part of the this one of those threats that you talked about, just to add more burden to the community. But I just think that climate change or climate action should help the revolution. Mm. And also the resistance movement can also help Myanmar to build more climate resilience. So I think there is some, there are actually many points that these two can benefit each other. So maybe I can talk a little bit more about the, so why the climate justice? I mean, what is climate justice? So maybe I can start from there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So climate justice is, I mean, maybe some of you heard about this from these perspectives that, historically the global south and this like least developed countries did not really contribute to the carbon emission, but suffering the most, this is clear form of injustice. And Myanmar definitely belongs to the lesser emitters, but suffering very much the grave future because of the climate change. More than 5 million Myanmar population live in the low-lying areas, very vulnerable to coastal erosion and also the sea level rise. Mm-hmm. And Myanmar has deadly cyclones. We had the Moka a few years ago, but then, I mean, it's flooding is annual event in Myanmar, affecting usually different parts of the country. But I mean, the flood damage is very severe. I mean, the rains are not coming as it's predicted. So, and then also Myanmar is a largely rural society. So lots of this rural population relying on primary industry are vulnerable to climate change. So I mean, it's Myanmar hasn't, although did not contribute to climate change, is suffering the impact. And So why is Myanmar suffering? Also, just think about the historical reasons being underdevelopment and also just being closed off from outside. There are many factors that really hinder the country to understand the where is the most vulnerability lies, and how can these sectors like the agriculture, fisheries, or even the urban planning can be better equipped for this more extreme climate in the future. But I think the most the primary source of vulnerability is actually with the conflict, because of the protracted displacement and just the constant insecurity in actually many parts of the country. Just, you know, these populations and communities go through for decades. I mean, this is the primary source of like vulnerability. I mean, yeah, climate change contributes and worsens, but the major social vulnerability comes from the conflict and this conflict environment. Or the military is actually getting most of their income from the fossil fuel revenues. Their oil and gas exports are the major income source. And the Myanmar military, unfortunately, they will always have a buyers because we are still dependent on fossil fuels. China, India, Russia will still be there, my friends. Also the Thailand, I think the Korean gas company is also still operating in the offshore gas field. So this industry will continuously feed Myanmar military money so they can buy these military assets. And this is, of course, not only the problem for Myanmar. I mean, you can also see the Russian aggression towards Ukraine. This is also funded by the natural gas. So we can think about these petrostates more broadly, but I mean, Myanmar's violence against civilians by the military is funded by fossil fuel, and also itself is just a source of great injustice. But then, I was just talking about this different or this exacerbated climate vulnerability of the conflict-affected people, right? So then you also you can also think about this equality, like across different Myanmar's populations. Like these ethnic minorities get discrimination just because of they may not speak Burmese as the first language. I mean, they just live in a remote area, don't have access to governance and social services. But also they have just a They're victimized by this conflict because they maybe didn't have access to education because they couldn't travel further. The schools are not operating because they could not get teachers. I mean, so these different forms of this negative impact of the conflict, it's really affecting the ethnic minorities. And of course, these populations have less capacity to adapt to climate change. So if you look at this climate change literature, the most predominant factor that influences your adaptive capacity, so that's the term that the climate change scholars use to assess how much capacity do you have when you face climate shock to recover. Yeah, so then a lot of this capacity is determined by household level ownership of properties, like land access is really crucial. But then I think minorities in these conflict zones have really hard time getting formal title. I mean, formal title may not be the determinant. Their access, they may not have the title, but they have the access. And there's some and also this kind of shocks are really like leaving some of this most poor people in the community behind, that they've become indebted and they have to maybe move to another area because they don't have the money to pay back the loan, etc. So all this type of negative socioeconomic impacts make them also really vulnerable to climate change, because as I said earlier, the Myanmar will face different weather patterns in the future. Also that there's a bit of uncertainty in this science. When I did this research last year for this climate peace and security fact sheet for Myanmar, so we looked at some of this physical impact And it was difficult to find like sort of one line explainer. So how will Myanmar get drier or wetter? Mm-hmm. So it's not very conclusive, but it looks like the raining patterns will change, that there will be more intensive rain. Mm-hmm. So it will be more prone to flooding. Also, the rains will be more unpredictable. So these are the kind of like the uncertainty it will bring. And we know that a lot of the Myanmar's farmers are relying on rainwater. They mm-hmm. don't have the irrigation facility. So then this adds to another layer of vulnerability of this already very much on the margin population. So then we're talking about this inequality becoming greater. And then marginalization of some of these persecuted communities will continue. Maybe the third aspect is something that's related to this extractive industry. Mm-hmm. Maybe you had have you had a guest on the podcast about rare earth mining?
Yes, we have.
Okay, so then maybe you should go back to the episode mm-hmm. and listen to it, or if you have already, then you know what I will say. So. There are currently about 300 mining sites open in Myanmar that's extracting rare earth minerals. And that is also, I mean, I think each electric cars will contain about half a kilo of rare earth minerals. So mm-hmm. that's quite a lot if you think about the number of electric vehicles being sold now. Mm-hmm. And instead of like now we're talking about, yeah, how do we recycle these materials better, or how do we like actually ethically source? Now we're racing to get more rare earth minerals, mm-hmm. right? So we're talking about the critical mineral security. So yeah. this is very a geopolitical and the security talk about this supply. And Myanmar is actually one of the suppliers, main suppliers.
25%, is that right?
Exactly. And then because the Chinese account for about half of the rare earth minerals, then the Myanmar supply is between 60 to 80% of the Chinese supply. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really significant supplier to the global supply chain. But then when you think about how it's affecting the environment at the local level. Yeah. So this is again, I mean, what is the difference between large-scale agrarian projects, like this land grabbing, mm-hmm. Like hydropower projects, solar panels, anything that's land-based, it has social and environmental impact. And in the case of rare earth mining, I'm so scared of like what kind of health impacts that these local communities have to bear, because they rely on untreated water, right? I mean, it's for their domestic use. And then these mining operations are very water intensive. This sort of like, yeah, so we need the transition for the global climate goals, but this requires the sacrifice of this very, very, very marginalized Myanmar people. And then at the same time, the armed groups are really profiting from the permits that they issue for the companies. Even the miners have to all get the permit from they used to get the permit from the NDAK, the Kachin militia group, but then now the KIO is governing this. I mean, I don't know how much of the improvement has been made. I expect the KIO to have a better environmental and labor and social safeguards. But this is contributing to the conflict economy, right? And then we're looking at several different aspects of injustices that this conflict will continue.
Yeah.
Miners, local communities, and the environment. So I think we're looking at, we're basically heading further away from the peace. Mm. Environmental destruction can last generations. So I think that's also one of the most emerging and more acute threats that we should really look at for seeking also the climate justice in Myanmar. And I do think that some of the narratives are quite concerning. That mm-hmm. yeah, so revolution and also the armed resistance cannot be done without money. So and then I think mm-hmm. this also has been the reason why the world of the sustainable mining. I think that's an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as sustainable mining, but this mining with the some sort of environmental and social safeguards, it's always presented as the answer. Like, no, I think it's also difficult to say, like, yeah, it should be completely banned. This $1.4 billion profit can help the revolution, can maybe feed into the resistance. But yeah, I mean, at what cost, right? So the actual cost that Myanmar has to bear is a lot higher than this $1.4 billion, I think, because we're also thinking about the future generations and the environment. There's no compensation paid for the environmental destruction. Mm-hmm. There's no alternative for this environment for a lot of the local people live there. They cannot simply move away. So yeah, I feel devastated about these issues when I read about it.
It's a really complex picture you're painting, because there's these different threads that are going into this analysis. You have the thread of massive displacement compounded by climate change, which makes, you know, when you lose your home and you're living under very less than ideal conditions, and then the weather patterns are not hospitable, then things go dramatically worse. You then have the extractive industries of fossil fuels, where they're selling the gas and oil to countries, which are then being converted into weaponry that they use against their own people. And then you have this really uncomfortable truth, inconvenient truth, we can say, of the green revolution, which is supported by so many environmentalists around the world as a necessary step forward, but this coming on the backs of some of the most marginalized people in the world. And it's almost like for us to save the world and move ahead and where we want to go with our environmental goals, these people just have to be sacrificed. This land just has to be sacrificed. And so so there's this very awkward and uncomfortable truth of the cost of this green revolution going forward. And this is one of these threads alone would be enough to devastate a population. You're talking about three of these threads simultaneously in the same place, in a place which is active conflict with assaults and airstrikes and landmines and arms on all sides, and people that are being impacted, you know, IDP camps that are growing by the number, which are then being targeted themselves. And, you know, you preface this conversation by expressing on one hand a concern that there's so much that people are dealing with now in Myanmar. On one hand, you don't want to drop another concern on there as a burden, and yet this issue and this topic is, whether you like it or not, is inextricably linked with these issues in Myanmar. It's not a question of by talking about them you somehow manifest them or conjure them up. They are there, and they are part of the conflict that we're seeing in from the revolutionary side to the military coffers to the international involvement. So, you know, it's just one more piece, one more layer and prism of understanding of an already immensely complicated and complex situation for people to get their minds around.
I mean, for sure. I mean, you're right that, I mean, of course, I said it at the beginning that I'm not trying to burden people more, especially the people who are so busy with important things, the life-saving things. And this is something, maybe it's really the down the line. And I think just let's think about it when we have the capacity to think about it, when we have the time to think about it, when we have the resources to think about it, when we have the stability, then we can think about it. When we have the democracy, we can think about it. But I also think that that's exactly why we are also here. Mm-hmm. And globally, we've been pushing this transformation, but it's just really thinking, I think I'm just talking about just globally, right? All the governments have been pushing this environmental concerns, and yeah, especially the climate related agendas. Just, you know, that's maybe the next government to think about it. I mean, that's also our habit, because it seems like we have not really reached the tipping point, although some scientists have said that we have crossed some of the planetary boundaries, that we overuse this planet. It's just a planet cannot cope anymore. So, mm-hmm. but So those are the natural physical boundaries. But I also think that people have been resilient enough, also Myanmar being extremely generous and charitable country. They have been able to help also the people who have been like displaced, who are in need of this public services, a lot of the volunteers and the people who just, you know, work for the community. Instead of focus on their own welfare, they also sacrifice their life for these communities and working for these communities mostly, right? So Myanmar has coped for this, at least for now. But I also do think that, yeah, so some of the urgent issues, if we don't address it now, it might not, well, I don't want to say things like, oh, it won't be possible, but it's more like it will be more expensive, it will be more damaging for the environment and for people, for the community in the future. So I think in many ways, let's do it when we have the time may not be the answer. But as I said, I mean, I think the finding how this climate action for Myanmar can benefit the revolution and how the resistance can support climate action. I think finding these synergies are really crucial.
Have you found those synergies?
So some of the very interesting questions and requests from the policymakers, right? So they're also very interested in supporting climate-related actions, like how but who they have to support and how they have to support, they would support. These are really the tricky questions. I think really the devil is in the detail, because you cannot obviously give the money to the Ministry of Natural Resources and Conservation in the NAPI, though. That will be completely the wrong approach to go, because we cannot ensure any accountability of such support. And also, we have seen that the conservation also has been weaponized in Myanmar, that some of these conservation projects were used to displace the IDPs or the local populations who were living in the area, or who were using this communal forest, for example. So those examples are already there. So at least in the context of Myanmar, they know that, yeah, the NAPIDO is not the right actors to engage, but there is still some of the programs are running inside the Myanmar that's also focusing on the environmental sustainability and resilience. Those projects are happening. But I also have found many of these environmental groups, youth groups, also the community groups, ethnic-based groups. So there's also a really long tradition of environmental activism in Myanmar.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so because a lot of them have been involved in this, also this dam resistance. So that's also my sort of a path to get to know this wonderful group of people. I think also a lot of them are just currently working on humanitarian issues, because everyone is working on humanitarian issues. But some of the groups, for example, I don't want to name, but it's this one, for example, group that was based in Tangji was basically educating village youth to learn about action research and the environmental impact assessment, like methodology. So they would actually learn how to understand the local impact when something happens in their communities. And also some of this Western NGO finance project was also facilitating training for they were not called like village youth leaders, but for me they were like village youth leaders to facilitate village level dialogues about the environmental governance. So a lot of this support was given to Myanmar during the opening era. I think that sort of inspired a lot of these groups, and some of these groups already existed from like 2000s or 1990s. So I mean, there is a strong tradition of also the environmental activism in Myanmar. So then you already have this group of people who are very, very knowledgeable about these intersections and who are probably already working on this on the ground, but in a very low profile and a careful manner. And I think some of the international donors have found these organizations to support. But I think how do we scale up, and how do we actually not just supporting one or two organizations, but like make this readily available for, or like supporting this kind of initiatives at the village level, mm-hmm. if they have some youth or like villagers who are interested in these issues. I'm also saying this because we have seen incredible level of political mobilization through the Spring Revolution movement. So there is a network of local community actors on the ground. So we can tap into that network and just to find the right people who are interested in working in climate issues or the local level resilience building and what works for them. And then try to find a way to really to facilitate the resource provision
right.
through those channels. So I think this is way more costly than a lot of the aid people would like to do, because a lot of the operation costs to know who are there, what they're doing, and this will be also probably very small amounts that are necessary to be channeled to different kind of locations. Mm. So yeah, I mean, I think that, but I really advocate, like, despite this high administrative cost, I think they must find a way to really channel support to the local level. Mm. I really believe in the communities.
Well, it's a really hard message to deliver when budget cuts are already happening from two organizations that have been traditionally supported for years and decades, and now those are floating without anything. And then on top of those losses, look, I mean, in no way am I discounting the importance of what you're saying, but it's just, we're operating in a very different climate, a very difficult climate to be advocating for aid for anything, because the whole notion of humanitarian aid and assistance globally is now being questioned with the U.S. withdrawal.
Right. I mean, I think that's the also one of the like biggest threats. That how do you argue for like climate action when the children's meals are being
cut? Right.
Right. I mean, so I also see the really the pressing issues. But I mean, this funding is the one thing, right? So, for just very small examples, I have worked with a friend who's running a renewable energy foundation in somewhere in Shan State, and his organization is basically a bunch of volunteers and some technicians, and they fix micro hydropower turbines in the communities, because some of these communities pay themselves to build these community grids, and then that is much better than having a household level solar panels or this grid, the gridless electricity. So they maintain, they expand the grid at the local community level, etc. And then he still managed to really operate. And the cost that they, because they are, these are the volunteers, they don't get a salary. They just work and they sleep in a foundation home. And so of course, this should not be the way that we expect everyone to work for free. But I mean, I'm just an example that they run on a very like shoestring operation. They just get like a few thousand dollars here and there to buy their equipments from China, which is mostly the solar panels and turbine parts are coming from there. And then they distribute them in the communities and make it work. And they also do the watershed conservation. So in many ways, some of these community actors can be empowered, not through the finance per se, but also transferring knowledge. Because also we have learned a lot about this different ways to support communities and boost renewable energy supplies through very small scale production, very micro scale production. So I think there are ways also that the non-financial support can be valuable, because some of the actors still on the ground working on this issue. So I still think that the priority should go to the humanitarian aid. I'm not saying that the climate change should be prioritized over humanitarian aid. But also, haven't you heard this from someone that a lot of the also development aid is now reframed as a climate aid? So I have also been in these conversations with some organizations that are typically humanitarian or development organizations, but they now also want to do climate because they may get may have access to more climate-related budget, because the climate budget apparently has not been slashed as much as the development budget, humanitarian budget, so they can still get access from some of the climate support, international climate support for the Global South.
Wow.
So then they're talking about, yeah, so we can do more of a climate resilient, climate it is humanitarian action, climate resilient development project, household support program, et cetera, et cetera. Then there is some more support can be given. So this is also some ways that the the development actors can access more funding.
It's so tragic, again, just to think about where Myanmar could have been going to if not for the coup. There's so many examples of programs and initiatives that were starting or underway. I mean, just one that I was familiar with was I had a friend who had spent years working across Chin State and had this major plan to provide solar panels across many towns and villages across Chin. And he was so excited about it because he's Australian, but he had traveled in Chin for many, many years and had places that had never been electrified and was looking at this big investment project of bringing electrification to these parts of Chin. And of course, the moment the coup happened, that could not become a reality, and a much worse reality came in its place. And so I wonder if you can look in your research, if you can talk about what was trending and what was possible during that transition period of perhaps certain realities that we could have seen that were lost.
Okay, so now I feel truly heartbroken. Yeah, I mean, so because I worked on hydropower, I think there was Myanmar was on the way to the expanding its national grid to substantial part of its country, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, in a way, Myanmar is it's also a bit of a false thing to say. There's only the 30% of the country has access to electricity. That's just the access to the national grid. I mean, the people have been paying money to get the electricity through the diesel generators and this hydropower dams in for example, in Waingmo Township in Kachin State, administered by KIO. It was also providing gridded electricity to parts of the country. So, I mean, there are these small grids, household level generators, and the solar panels. So people are getting electricity, but they just were not good enough for having sustained and stable connection. So in a way, this national grid is still very critical for Myanmar to have some sort of electricity connection. I think some of the IFIs, the international financial institutions, were doing is that they were laying out plans for this grid expansion and also connecting the small grids, right? So this Chin State can have their own mini grids within the Chin State because it's also a very remote area. So this kind of mini grids are very, I mean, in a way, they're desirable because instead of connecting to the main grid, they can also have their independent grid systems and then connecting them further for more insurance by connecting to the bigger grid. But I mean, first establish the small grid and then expanding further. So I mean, these kind of projects were on the way and they were just being sort of rolled out phase by phase. So it was happening, but also it was happening under this very corrupt ministry, which also a lot of the corruption was there in the electricity sector. So this one, so this friend that I mentioned, so this information comes from him, not from me, that he was saying so some of these villagers that he was working with was asked to pay something like two lakh per household for connection. So every household had to pay this much money, and this was asked by the GAD officers, so you must pay this much. But then they were like, no, this is ridiculous. This is too much money. What are you going to do with this money? And then they found their own engineer to connect. And then it was one third of the cost. So, this is just a very corrupt system. They're just, just doing this also to profit themselves. And then all these dams, there were many dams that were on the pipeline. I think there was French, Austrian, Norwegian companies were involved in the dam development. I think they all pulled out after the coup. So maybe revisiting these plans maybe that's not the worst thing happened for Myanmar. Maybe that's actually a good thing that some of this large-scale development projects were paused. Mm-hmm. But yeah, well, it's not for the good reason, right?
Yeah.
So that's what that has happened. And the conservation projects, I'm just thinking about the some of the works that some of the international conservation organizations are doing. So a lot of those projects were also, I mean, partly criticized, but I mean, they were also quite useful in a way that they were building capacity for the ministry officials and the sort of, you know, increasing understanding of about the conservation. So, I mean, some positive aspects, although like a lot of problematic approaches from the critical conservation point of view. But then I don't know if you know about this Talwin Peace Park, maybe there was a guest maybe talking about this, but this type of indigenous conservation method was also spreading within Myanmar, right? So, but now it's very difficult because of this whole areas that there were peace parks that are being bombed and everything. So, but if we didn't have the coup, I'm sure there would be more indigenous conservation areas in Myanmar current day. We probably could have seen more of them. But now it's just a very difficult to but I know that they're still working on this. Yeah, yeah. But I know that they're working in extremely difficult circumstances.
I think these are like the extremes of Myanmar. This is a snapshot that is showing the extremes of Myanmar as we see in so many ways, that the extremes of, on one side, on the positive side, the indigenous community and the resistance, just take a moment and take a pause to just reflect on how amazing it is that there is this sense of environmental care and wanting to preserve one's environment and one's habitat and, you know, do right by that, and that these are values that you find at the local level, even as so much in society has there have been challenges on so many levels and so many hardships, that even amid that there has been a popular ethos that some have taken up, that this is a priority for them, even in the hardest of conditions and situations. That's really a beautiful thing to take a moment to acknowledge and to express, that that you don't find in every other place that you might go to. And yet, as there is this this ground grassroots attempt to want to look at environmentalism, there is from the top down, you just see this horrendous military, this corruption, this extraction of natural resources, this displacement, everything else. And so you really have this this polarity, this dichotomy of two different extremes that are operating there at once. And as we look at the before and after of the coup, you know, you find a situation where there as you put it, that there was a trajectory of people working towards a certain goal or a certain aspiration, and now in the wake of the coup, that's just, as you say, people are still working towards it, but it is so hard. You know, when you're operating under, it's active warfare in so many parts of the country, and when you're in active warfare and 4 million displaced or whatever the number is up to now, it is just much harder to, on top of all that, still be pursuing these kind of values when so much of the country has been torn apart.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, for example, but these conservation groups are really amazing because they also work together with some of the EROs, right? So but I think the alliance was made during the opening era, that they basically recognize like protecting their environment, protecting the space is both important for this ethno-national goals as well as for the conservationist goals. So in a way, they have these meeting points, right? So that they can see that, yeah, this is valuable for both.
That's great.
Yeah. So I mean, that's the kind of this or synergy or the connection that I'm also searching for now. Like, so because also, well, without really considering the climate change, the peace that can come to Myanmar is only partial, because also this earthquake was a very is such a tragic event, and we did not see it coming, so this was completely unpredictable event, so this is different from the climate related hazards, but I think the climate induced events like the cyclone and flooding and or the major droughts, I think we can better equip to that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no such thing as a natural disasters, actually. So mm-hmm. the disasters are all shaped, and they're the results of political and social decisions and mm-hmm. economic decisions. They're not natural. And the climate, for sure, it's climate-related hazards are definitely not. If there's a disaster coming from a cyclone, this is not only the cyclone's doing. It's also this political decision, so not evacuating the Rohingya,
or the
Rohingyas not wanting to leave the area because of their experience in the past mm-hmm. of the displacement and killing. Mm-hmm. It's not only the cyclone that leads to the human life loss. But yeah. I mean, earthquake. Yeah, but the earthquake response, you also see a lot of this political impact, right? The humanitarian responders could not go in.
Yeah.
So in many ways, politics really dictate how we are affected by the environment and how we affect the environment. So yeah, I think the politics must come first. I think we need to mm-hmm. ensure prioritize this. Very desirable political change, yeah. So mm-hmm. in the future, very soon, hopefully. But unless we also consider for the climate and the environment, I think we also cannot expect a better future for Myanmar and also the future population, the future generations. Mm.
Yeah. I realize that that the conversation is heading a bit in a downward cycle of a pessimism, which is, which we have to be honest, we're not trying to put a bright spin on these things. That's the nature of where we're at in the analysis. That being said, I wonder, are there any silver linings from this moment or things unexpected, positive, outcomes or potentialities that you see now that you didn't before that might balance with this darker picture that we're also painting?
Ooh, that's a really hard one. I mean,
I guess that's the answer right there.
Yeah, because I mean, I think the one kind of this current challenge, of course, it was an expected challenge, but this like now this protractedness of the struggle. And the disappointingly resilient military, right? I mean, they also seem to just get some sort of break after every crisis, which is very frustrating. But I think the revolution is still ongoing, and a lot of people have dedicated their life to support this revolution or being part of it. I think. Alone, that is remarkable, and I think we need to recognize that.
Sure.
These people who are on the front lines and who are in the resistance area supporting this they should be writing their own stories. I'm not here to say what's going to happen in the future. Mm. But yeah, I mean the situation is bad, and I think we really need to support Myanmar from the international community. But I mean, I still think that there is a pool of people who support Myanmar. I mean, I think there was also like a book that was written by some Scandinavian academics that was written in Swedish, and it was about there is still hope or something like that. And I think there was also one chapter about Myanmar. Mm. Yeah, so I mean, I think people are still trying to this raise awareness, and I'm from South Korea, and I think a lot of the South Koreans are seeing our own past from Myanmar because mm-hmm. we also struggled from the military dictatorship for mm-hmm. years and decades, and then the democratic movement really had to suffer for a very long time. So I think there is also a lot of solidarity of countries like South Korea, maybe Taiwan, also others to support Myanmar continuously. So. Mm.
We don't hear so much about Korean Burmese connections, or I don't at least, and it's not something we've explored yet on the podcast. What can you tell us about the way that Myanmar, the current struggle in Myanmar is perceived in Korea today, and what kind of support is there for it?
I think there is a very popular like support for Myanmar, Myanmar's democratic movement. There has always been just a little bit of a background about South Korean context. So South Korea had a military dictatorship from 1970s and I'm not really good at my own history, 60s or 70s when the military coup happened and President Park Chung-hee took over power. And then after he was assassinated, we had two more dictators until we had a civilian government. But then this like reconciliation was done very late. I mean, people who were killed during this dictatorship era, they were only recognized in early 2000s in the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And people were still stigmatized. Maybe not present, but I mean, just until a few years ago. So this has affected many people's lives very deeply. So people have very deep connection to resistance against the dictatorships, especially the military dictatorships. So when the coup happened in Myanmar, there was a lot of media coverage in South Korea. Mostly the progressive media has covered extensively on the situation. And I also, when I visit South Korea, sometimes I see very random kind of fundraising pots for Myanmar, either for the resistance and they're used. And I went to my parents' Buddhist temple and I saw the like this donation pot also at the temple. So in many ways, people really are aware of Myanmar's struggle, and I think there's a really strong popular support. However, South Korean companies like the POSCO International and Korean Gas Company, they own gas fields operations in Rakhine State. So they're also doing a lot of this businesses with the junta. And some of you know this really beautiful Lotte Hotel near the Inya Lake. That's the Myanmar military company's holding. The Lotte is paying. Actually, not the Lotte, but POSCO International is paying the junta money. So in a way, there's a very contradiction that especially the previous government had also said a lot of critical messaging to the military junta. They're very concerned about the situation. But then continue to do the business while people are very much supporting. So it's a bit of a confusing picture. Right. But I mean, I do think that there is a lot of support.
That's interesting. There's popular support there. I did not know that.
Yeah, and I think so. Yeah, since the 1990s, the military dictatorship was removed, and we had a civilian president. It took really a long time, also, to really look at our own democratic struggle with more constructive eyes, because it was still very politicized, and then people still didn't want to talk about it, but everyone was happy that the military no longer had anything to do with the politics.
Yeah.
And the civil-military relationship in Korea is very different from Myanmar. Of course, that's very civilian focused, and they made sure the military can never take over the politics because of this legacy. So now the people have a very strong democratic preference, although some young men, especially, they're apparently more pro-authoritarian traits, like everywhere else. But most of the population still fundamentally believe in democracy. And I think Myanmar, I think there has also been a lot of Koreans been in Myanmar. There's a lot of cultural exchanges. There are a sizable number of Myanmar migrant workers in South Korea. So. So there is a strong connection between these two countries, and I think also the language can be quite easy for Koreans to learn Burmese and Burmese to learn Korean. So it's there's also that connection. Korean missionaries are in Myanmar in ethnic minority areas mostly.
Really?
Yeah, so because Korean missionaries go everywhere, including Myanmar.
When I
was in Kachin State, the immigration officer just looked at me and then my passport. Is like, oh, you must be a missionary. Off you go.
which Christian sect is that?
Mostly Evangelicals, but also Baptists. Also sometimes they go. But
interesting.
Yeah. So they have many of the civilian like people to people connections.
And then so you have Christianity going from Korea to Myanmar, but then what happens with Buddhism? Is there a Buddhist influence that goes back the other way from Myanmar to Korea?
I think I see also a lot of the Southeast Asian influence in Myanmar Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Like for example, I just saw, so because there was the before, just before the Lent I visited, so we called it like Buddha's birthday, so Buddha's coming day, that was on the, this year was like 5th of May, according to the lunar calendar. See, I'm like also a bad Buddhist. I raised a Buddhist, but I haven't really practiced. Mm-hmm. So my terms of this religious holidays are pretty off. But and then I saw this, you know, the ritual to wash Buddha mm-hmm. with the water that we never did as in the Buddhist temple in mm-hmm. Korea. We usually just walk around the pagoda. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, what is this? And then someone explained to me, oh yeah, this is kind of some one of the sayadaws, the monks went to Thailand or somewhere in Southeast Asia, and then they mm-hmm. saw this and thought it was a very nice tradition. Oh. And so we also want to do this as a purifying before the, you know, the this coming holiday. So mm-hmm. so they for example have that. They also have a more meditation mm-hmm. sessions in one of the sort of like prominent Buddhist sites. Mm-hmm. So they have this type of I can see that the sort of like more emphasis on the meditation, this is definitely new. And the different types of also chanting, although we have a Mahayana Buddhism, so it's a different school, but I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, this is something new that I see every time. Mm.
I know from my experience of being in Burmese monasteries, when I was at international monasteries, there were always huge contingencies of Korean and Vietnamese communities who would come in mass and as monks and nuns and lay people, and somewhat Taiwanese as well, other pockets of Asian communities, but the Koreans and the Vietnamese, they came in numbers and they came in groups, and they came in such numbers, and they were at every monastery everywhere, that it did make me start to be curious about what influence they were bringing back. And they largely kept to themselves. It was somewhat hard to integrate or talk with them. They kind of they really did come as a group, and you know, and practice and stay for extended periods as a group. Mm-hmm. But because they were always there, and they were at most international monasteries I'd go to, it did make me really curious as to if those numbers are coming and staying for that time, there must be connections back in the home country, and they must be bringing some of that, you know, methodology and mindset and practice, culture, religiosity, whatever. Mm-hmm. They must be bringing it back to, you know, some level of community back in their home countries.
I mean, I think that's probably something that I don't really know about, but yeah, I mean, I can imagine that this kind of exchanges are usually influencing how people understand the key Buddhist concepts. I mean, maybe the visible changes are not showing because also the structure of the Korean monastic orders, that we have a big this very, very big, the Joge mm-hmm. order is the number one, the largest Buddhist sect in Korea. So and then they have a pretty centralized management of mm-hmm. the monks, and each individual monks can have like their own interpretation. But I mean, it's also quite limited because they usually don't give sermons. They chant. So they don't really interpret for you. So mm-hmm. there are some of these popular monks who likes to actually explain their questions. And a lot of the questions actually posed on the individual lives and people's values in life instead of like politics and the more of a social issues. Mm-hmm. The social engagement is somewhat limited, I feel like, in Korea, although they do like to help people. Mm-hmm. I think there's some Buddhist monks also did some environmental protection mm-hmm. Movements, and I think there was also one tunnel that cut part of the ecosystem in one of the key central part of South Korea that triggered some of the monks to participate in this demonstration. So those things have happened.
Yeah.
So in as a like a Buddhist order, they don't really engage so much in the either politics or like mm-hmm. larger social issues. Yeah. But I mean, there's also not the major order, but the commune Sunim. I don't know his English name, but he has been engaged also with the Myanmar Buddhist.
Really?
And then, yeah, so there has been some exchanges. Mm. I think his volunteers has gone to Myanmar to support humanitarian aid, and I think they also support the Myanmar Buddhist groups. So I think there has been also some of this organization-to-organization exchanges.
So that's an example of engaged Buddhism in Korea then.
Yeah, exactly. So this is... Yeah, this is something that I don't know so much about, but I have seen it because, yeah, every time I go to Korea, I spend quite a bit of time at the Buddhist temples because of my family.
Yeah,
my family members, like some of my aunt is going to this other monastic order that's more to that more engaged Buddhist tradition. Mm. So then they talk about also the changing the society and also changing your neighborhoods and more of a social engagement. Mm. I think they also talk about how they need to address like the poverty in certain area and etc. So there is a bit of that, but then every time I also. I am there because I'm also partly interested in this Buddhist links, so that I discover this kind of connections, which is also interesting.
And Myanmar has come on the radar of them.
Yeah, for sure, because Myanmar is very well known also to many Koreans because of these linkages, as I explained. But yeah, during the transition era, there was just a lot of the tourists going there, and they're going to the monasteries, they're learning about the Buddhism, becoming the missionary, they're doing business in Myanmar, doing opening some restaurants and the small businesses. I think the countries are quite well connected.
Right. Being someone who came from Korea and then becoming an academic focusing on largely Myanmar issues, do you feel that there's been anything in your background or upbringing that has you look at Myanmar in perhaps a different way than your colleagues?
For sure, because I say that I grew up in a developing country and then my country became developed.
Interesting, right.
For example, my grandma's place where I mostly spent my childhood didn't have a running toilet. It was one of those latrines that need to be manually scooped out by a truck. So that's kind of how I grew up. And then now you don't see that anymore. And yeah, everyone has... the connected toilets. Besides everything else that's going well for the country, but then, for example, I have vivid memories of people protesting against dams in South Korea when I was young, because they also built many dams, and a lot of this because the country is very mountainous, so can generate a few hundred megawatts from one dam, and they used to provide stable electricity to major cities, and we used to call these people. Who are displaced by dams. So there's a special word for them. They're called Sumormin, which means they're destroyed by water people, the people who are destroyed by water. So that's those people we refer to who had to be displaced because of the hydropower dams. Mm-hmm. So I have vivid memories of this. So when I hear about these issues about dams and displacement, I didn't feel like this is something new to me.
Yeah.
I felt immediate connection.
Wow.
Some of these dam reservoirs, you can see there were old houses, there have even Buddhist temples were underwater. So, those are actually the villages were being drowned. So I think maybe that's one reason why I got so interested in hydropower as a subject to research, but also just experiencing the fast-paced development. As a child to grow up in a country that was changing very fast.
Yeah.
So maybe that has something to do with the choice of research topic.
It's so interesting because as you talk about Korea's development, there's two directions you can go with this. One is obviously going from a place of poverty and underdevelopment, military dictatorship, lack of freedoms, to a place where there's a lot better healthcare and education opportunities and more freedoms in society and more comfort, luxuries, et cetera, all good things you could say.
But then on the other hand, you know, I've heard the term hypercapitalism used in the context of Korea, and, you know, rampant materialism and isolationism as well, and, you know, lack of connections that have widespread use of internet is, I think I've seen some studies that, like, internet hours in Korea are like the highest per capita anywhere, that it's just like super connected internet wise. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as you chart this growth in society and in your life and your family and friends' life in mm-hmm. Korea that happened before your eyes, and you look at the Myanmar example, I wonder if you're kind of balancing these two different realities and threads that, you know, the obviously everyone wants, I think everyone listening to this wants to see Myanmar go from the problems and the conflict and the strife to some kind of stability, electricity, education, healthcare, infrastructure. Yes, but, you know, it is hard to bring that in. And then with it, you also bring the other elements that come, say some of the problems that advanced capitalist states have. And so how do you look at Myanmar's growth when you look at the goods and maybe the not so goods of where Korea's growth has brought the society?
Yeah, I mean, I totally get your point about like being very critical about this like industrialized development as a goal, because also like that's one reason why I've been studying environment issues and also like climate change and mm-hmm. The war, this sustainable development, not just the industrialization and this fast-paced development mm. without really considering social justice, equity, and et cetera. So, yeah, I think every country has its own path, and I think it's very unfair that because I study Myanmar, and then sometimes I've get into these conversations that, yeah, how come South Korea reverted the martial law that the president was trying to effectively basically take over the country, maybe mm-hmm. like basically like posing a coup, right? And yeah, then they reverted. And I was trying to explain, yeah, there's this constitution and there's this institutionalized democracy that's in place. So yeah, so they had this procedure that if you had an X number of parliamentarians in the session and they veto the coup, they oppose the coup, then they oppose the martial law, then it becomes canceled legally, and then they can take the investigation against everyone who was involved, right? So, but then also there was a lot of this middle level or this officer level resistance. So there was a group of special forces were eating like cup noodles and some snacks at a convenience store nearby the parliament because they refused to go into the parliament to arrest the parliamentarians. And they also refused to carry weapons in there. They refused to arrest people. So they delayed their operations to a degree. So there was a bit of this passive resistance by the military because they also knew that they were committing a crime if they did everything. So in a way, like you can sort of see like, yeah, I mean, that's pretty incredible that happened, but also it could have not happened that way. It could have also that everyone just followed the orders, just being good soldiers, didn't ask questions, and just did what they were told to do. Mm-hmm. That could have happened, but you know that did not happen, fortunately, and then it was reverted. And also for the development, I mean, I think there are lots of like, I mean, sometimes I really hate like going to some place that I really loved, and then I go there a few years later and it's like a completely destroyed because of some development projects. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I still remember as a child, we loved to go into this one like pond, like a little stream, and it's just a natural stream and it has a little pond. And we used to go there every year for about maybe 3-4 years. Mm. And then one year my dad was like, okay, we will not go in there because they built a dam upstream and then no water is coming through. So the area is completely dry. So we got there just for the heck of it, just to see what happened. It's just completely dried. So this type of changes are very, it happens like very quickly and everywhere without sort of like expecting and also like questioning, like, is this really necessary? Well, maybe there was not a dam, maybe there was a reservoir. I'm not entirely sure, but I saw the wall and then the water was behind this wall. So that's what I remember. So Yeah, so you can become critical, but I mean, still the logic in South Korea is that the development and the economic benefits come first, and that I think really had a lot of a lot of issues. Like I think it was some time ago that OECD countries did some survey and asking like, what do you care the most? And South Korea was the only country that said like money. It was something like material safety.
Yeah.
Was the most thing that they care about. Mm-hmm. There was all the other countries were family, which is rightfully so. And then family was like number two or three. Mm. And this is shown in a lot of this, disappointing news about the families are separated because of the financial issues. A lot of this materialistic development is also, it's really depriving people of like the spiritual richness that I think the older generation maybe had. And because they always did everything for the family and maybe that was also false, but mm-hmm. then still it wasn't all about the money, mm-hmm. that the people with families will help each other. It's more than even now, and now a lot of the disputes, social conflict, and also you know about this low birth rate. People don't have children. That I think is a very strong indicator that the happiness is not there. So I mean, I think this Korean development model, it's definitely has improved people's lives, and it's good for good for the country. But maybe being too fast and maybe not really considering the social justice and also having this kind of a welfare that really protects people from completely being in poverty, because in South Korea, like the pension system is also it's not enough if you haven't worked for the entire life to have a livable pension, for example. So mm-hmm. so a lot of people struggle economically. So that's also something that's very obvious to me, because now I have been living in Sweden, and now I'm in the Netherlands for a year. But then these countries have much longer traditions of like this welfare state, and you can see that even if you get sick or you become unemployed, there's a way to go back. In Korea, one of those things can really mean that you and your family might not survive. So that's very, very sad. So I think that just going back to Myanmar, I think Myanmar is charting its own path mm-hmm. for its future, and I don't think that the comparative model of Myanmar must follow these other examples. I think that's also quite irrelevant sometimes, because also geopolitically, Myanmar does not have this kind of ally who can really giving the economic opportunity for the export. I mean, that was also the situation during the Cold War, that Korea really benefited from gaining foreign currency. So now, yeah, but personally, I think you're right that I am definitely my engagement with Myanmar is a bit of it's very personally enriching, because I also see a lot of the interesting interactions among people. I also really admire a lot of this people who it's not really just about the economy and money. It's really about something that was greater. Almost like larger than life, also do think that that's really interesting.
Did you feel that was a spirit in Korea before that was more prevalent, that has been a bit diminished with the hyper capitalism?
Well, I think for example, like I do very clearly remember in 1998 we changed like a labor law, so you could get fired for. Or you don't get the permanent contract. The companies are not really obligated to hire you more than 2 years, mm-hmm. and then that limit became 7 years. So you will never. You can be in a situation you can never get a permanent contract. So I mean, back in the days, people also were very involved in activism because they could also survive without money and having a paying jobs. Mm. But then that labor insecurity really became predominant. Mm. And then the labor market became very unstable. Workers lost all rights. Then I think it's just you don't have anything. Mm-hmm. You can be a volunteer, but also you'll be told by other people, like, how will you survive? Mm. Korea is not the kind of country you can survive on land.
Yeah.
You can become a hobby farmer, but if you want to be a professional farmer, that's also requiring a lot of capital. So it's not like in Myanmar that you can actually live off to a degree. I mean, of course, you cannot. I mean, the subsistence farming is also quite a fantasy that you cannot. You always need money for school and medicine, but yeah, that's completely not possible in Korea. The breeding costs money. Mm. So then this hyper capitalist society is definitely. It is a result of neoliberal reforms took place over decades. Yeah.
Mm. Right. Going back to the Korean president declaring martial law and the fallout from that, I just want to bring in a story there that when that happened, I'm in a Milk Tea Alliance signal group, and when that took place, everyone that was in that group, activists, Milk Tea Alliance activists from all over Southeast Asia, immediately mobilized to say, what can we do? Within hours, they mobilized to say, what can we do? And there was, I think, one or two Koreans in that group that they were asking, like, how can we help you? Tell us how to be involved. Can we amplify your message? Would you rather have us stay silent? What is it that we can do to help? And among that were many Burmese activists. So I just want to call out, you know, how remarkable this sense of solidarity is, that you have Burmese activists that are, you know, really facing the most difficult situation any of us can imagine, and yet still cognizant and aware of when this has happened, not just aware of when this is happening in Korea, but immediately rising up. And, you know, this, if it's happening to one of us, it's happening to all of us, immediately rising up and saying, what can I do to help? What can we in Myanmar, who are under threat ourselves in unimaginable ways, but what can we do to help to make sure that what's happening over there gets known? And it was really a remarkable, moment of interaction.
Wow, that's, I can almost imagine, like, the chats popping up and everyone gets super engaged, and that's really touching. And I think that's also, you know, because democracy is like an ecosystem. Mm. One democracy is attacked, it's basically attacked for everyone, right? Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's this also beauty and power of alliance. Climate activism is also quite similar in a way that the activists working in different countries, they also like have a very strong bond. But I think this Milk Tea Alliance is really amazing, and I really hope that all the countries in the alliance and also associated countries, so that, I don't know, the friends, they all have a better future. I mean, now it's just a democratic backsliding. It's a global phenomena. It's very concerning, and I think we just need to really just call for more solidarity. Also, that's really key. Just looking ahead in the future, right? That's really amazing.
So, going back to this climate justice and awareness of environmental conservation and climate change in Myanmar, I wanted to ask you if you've seen, or to what degree you've seen this as an awareness or a policy on the standpoint of the NUG.
I think there is definitely an interest and willingness within the NUG to think more about this. I mean, I think the NUG is also very much aware of the rare earth minerals and the issues related to it. I think NUG has a lot to work with, because also there has been this climate change strategy that was published in 2017, 2018, I can't remember. But anyway, there was this policy document, and also the some of the NUG, the minister and the deputy minister have been working also very closely with these issues. So I think they're very aware of it. Mm. But I think it's difficult for them perhaps to have a proper, like, a follow up of the previous, for example, the policy in this current time. Perhaps I think that may not be easy, because it would require consultation, proper like drafting of this document. But I do think that they have been tracking the logging situation, right? So they have been doing quite systematic work mm-hmm. on the like sort of recording illegal logging since the coup, mm-hmm. and then try to sort of like document some of these issues to a degree. But because I think they recognize the centrality of a natural resource extraction mm-hmm. in the as a part of the conflict economy. So mm-hmm. I think they're aware of it. But I mean, also the energy is currently just I mean, they have this whole legitimacy, but they're also just a bunch of volunteers at the moment. They have a lot to do, and I think it can be improved for sure. Hopefully energy will have more discussions about this in the future. Maybe part of their mission and the goals.
And then I also want to come back to this contrast of. We could look at hydroelectric power and how to meet the modern needs of a growing community, then, you know, there has to be some kind of loss or sacrifice somewhere else. And then the Green Revolution, to power this whole Green Revolution the world over, you need the rare earth, and so much of that comes from Myanmar, and it's such a dirty, toxic, terrible process of doing, but it's... it can happen in this one place where these one people are effective and then affected, and then the world benefits from this growing green revolution. And so, when you're thinking through these ethical considerations of kind of like the sacrifice of the some for the good of the many, I guess is how it could be framed. Although there's certainly other ways that could be framed or looked, but it is some kind of tension or contrast that. That has to be held, and it's not a pure just ethical consideration, because there's also people making a whole lot of money in the process, and whole swaths of land and communities that are devastated forever as a result, choosing which exactly are going to be preserved and where it's going to be affected, that comes into play as well. So it's a very complicated determination to have to make, but it seems to me it's not black and white as well, because there is this, I have to acknowledge, there is this benefit that's coming for wider communities as a result of those that are impacted. And so how do you approach these tensions and these ethical considerations?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is very challenging to navigate, both as a researcher and someone in academia, and also as a private person, like as an individual who uses laptops and telephones also mm-hmm. contain this mineral. So yeah, I think everyone. It's a little bit like you can do recycling. You can not have a car. You maybe don't even fly because you're so committed to the climate goals. I have actually these friends who are like vegans. They don't fly, and they always eat ecological food. I mean, they do everything in their private citizens to make difference. And this is of course very noble, and we should respect this. At the same time, I mean, we also. So this small steps and small actions are important, but not as important as the like decisions really can be made by your government, and also at the international climate governance scenes. So yes, I mean this current model of green transition is like we're not slowing down our production and consumption. Mm-hmm. Production and consumption will continue, and we might even produce and consume more. Mm-hmm. Just we're gonna replace it with the non-fossil fuel inputs, and it's this type of the same approach, mm-hmm. Without considering actual like limits and also the social and environmental impacts of like so what does this transition actually entail? I think this is something that's fundamentally problematic. Just this example about production and consumption. So if you look at even 1992, the Rio Convention, now it's so long ago, but still one of the most influential environmental agreement that the countries had at the UN. Mm-hmm. There was a even resolution about production and consumption. And yeah, when I was doing an internship at the UN, and I was at the department where they follow up this Rio resolutions. Mm. So it sounds very boring. Mm. So we're looking at this something like 20-year-old resolutions, and we're kind of following up every year at the General Assembly. And then I was looking at some of this resolutions, and apparently this resolution on production and consumption, it's still hugely politically problematic. No country, no government will support this resolution. Mm-hmm. And because less production means less growth or degrowth. Mm-hmm. And no government can say, yeah, I'm gonna make degrowth my political pledge for climate resilient future.
Yeah.
That just is not happening.
Right.
So this is a very, very, very fundamental problem that we need to really look beyond our current way of living. Mm-hmm. To see the what can be actually done differently without harming the environment and also the most marginalized people. I mean, there is a rare earth mining reserve in Sweden, mm-hmm. in northern part of the Arctic region, but that mining site will probably not be exploited because they can do it cheaper in Myanmar.
Oh, wow.
Without paying any basically cost for the environmental and social damage, isn't it? I mean, why would the companies?
Yeah.
Doing that in Sweden, environmentally and ethically, sustainably as possible, I mean, in that space, will cost a lot more money than just buying it from China if they allow them to purchase. So in that way, the political economy is just not really favoring the marginalized people. And we will always look for the lower bottom. It's really the race to the bottom. It's the old minings are happening in these horrible situations because these are the cheapest. Mm-hmm. So mining industry in a sense, it's in the industry wise. So this is also not my expertise. I only did a little bit of research on this because of some papers that I'm writing. But so some of the professors who I work with, who was specialized in mining, so mining industry is just. It involves in many cases they don't use violence per se, but then they work with the actors who can provide them security means violence. Yeah, and then all these problems comes with it's just the industry wide problem.
Yeah. So personally, would you be advocating an approach of encouraging less production, less consumption?
Yeah, I mean, there's also a sort of movement and also the scholarly turn towards degrowth. So I have a couple of colleagues in, for example, Lund University, who did climate resilient peace. Mm-hmm. And then she's looking at degrowth in Puerto Rico as mm-hmm. Something that's actually, so how does that work? The degrowth in that context. So what does that mean? We want to have this climate resilient future, and also that can be peaceful and just. Then basically her answer is the only answer is degrowth. So it's, this is also now gaining more and more traction. I also do have looked at it more. I think it is very interesting and compelling. Mm. Yeah, degrowth is not always the most popular thing in anywhere because it sounds so unrealistic.
I was going to ask, is it realistic?
Yeah, but so I mean, I think a lot of the I think a lot of these current patterns of the world is just not really built for this. So I think it really, it will require more transformation than we would have done with this transition model. So yeah, I think the pathways are all they lie in front of us. I mean, the IPCC scenarios, they look at this 5 or 6 or 7 scenarios, right? There's different models, and then this really little growth is also part of it. I mean, yeah, so more radical climate action, cutting down the emission. That's not the same as the degrowth, but I think degrowth may lead us to a slightly less consuming and a producing future.
But in the case of modern Myanmar, where you have so much of the country that has never been electrified, and if there is a way to have hydropower, then I know that the past examples are not good ones to put in there, because these are having very minimal benefit to Myanmar with a huge cost, and you know, top level Chinese that are benefiting in other ways. But you know, if you were to bring in a civilian government and a post-military state that was interested in building hydropower in some places to be able to electrify large parts, then you would have that tension there, right? And you would have to make those choices.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, no energy comes free. So every electricity that you use has a cost. So, I mean, I think during the transition period, there was also more like studies about how to build hydropower with the least environmental damage. Also, the siting is basically the most important and the most irreversible thing that you can do in hydropower development. Once you choose the site, very little things can do to change the impact. So siting is really important, and some of the studies. I think it was Conservation International, but I mean, there were the studies commissioned by this organization looking at the watershed level instead of each site, to see perhaps just developing one stream of tributary intensively in a cascade is better than blocking every river.
Mm-hmm.
So those kind of efficiency discussions were happening. I think they were also quite influential for the ministerial levels. I think it could have also informed a better development of hydropower. I think this community level grid systems were very promising, like your friend in Chin State, for example. I don't want to say this because it's gonna really overshadow the sort of the hopefulness. But I mean, I think so much of this kind of technical and management-based solutions are so fragile, because I'm also thinking about Gaza, and it's like a rooftop revolution, because a lot of the Gaza houses had solar panels on the roof, and this was giving them electricity, which are, you know, now no longer functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, without the electricity, they don't have water. So in a way, a lot of this kind of a solution-oriented approaches are very much dependent on political stability, conflict. So I just want to say that, yes, I mean, we can look at this genius solutions and the good approaches for this electricity and the also climate mitigation and adaptation. But I think after all, we need a government that's not murderous and accountable.
Right.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. That the first thing that we need is that.
Mm. And then on this topic of the green revolution, you know, how do you make these ethical decisions where the belief behind this green revolution is that you're going to be making a shift that's better for the world? It just so happens that this one community and region of Myanmar is severely impacted, marginalized already, and impacted, you know, given how toxic this whole industry is, that these are lands that may never be lived in again. And as you said, how devastating and terrible these impacts are, we don't know. But how do you approach these decisions? Does that just mean you don't have a green revolution, or if these are the only materials that can be used to power it, and these are the places where they're located, how do you make those decisions?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really a tough question, and also, yeah, I mean, for sure, I think this green and just transition like another one, the green. I mean, I think some people even write like a, you know, quotation mark on green because what is green? I mean, talk about green hydrogen. How do you make it green? So I think, this is a bit of a. I mean, you know, like if you look at the renewable energy sector, the biggest investors are like oil companies, right? I mean, so a lot of it is like for them is a diversifying, slightly greenwashing. So a lot of this is like very. Because we're still stuck in the old system, then it's just about the choice of who are the victims. Mm-hmm. So, but this transition, which also is not really happening very fast, and also in Europe because of the war, the further militarization, all of that is really also slowing down. So the Trump administration 2.0, all of this is now also being slowed down. So transition is still probably the second best option. Now that's also been hindered. But I think it's about the sourcing, and I think there's also a lot of the discussions about recycling rare earth minerals, and how do you also produce, how do you also source more ethically? So a lot of this like a pressure for where transparency, also the tracing, and also just, you know, just make sure that some of these areas that are not really control of any state, like in Myanmar, and then the mining operations are happening. It just needs some sort of oversight. And yeah, I'm also here, I will be interested in like hearing from someone who's in charge of this rare earth mining areas now, right? This ERO just want to know what they think about this long-term environmental and health impact.
We had on Mike Davis from Global Witness speaking about it, and it was just, I mean, what he described, it was just devastating. It was just awful. I had no idea.
Yes, I mean for sure. I mean, I need to go back and listen to that. I mean, it sounds like a good episode. I should not miss. And so I'm also like also slightly concerned. Like, so if they do know, will they like sealed off this area and displace also people? Mm-hmm. Like, so I think you cannot also like advise. So this is uninhabitable. It's a lot of risk, and also the propensity of the actions are like then relocation, and where would these people go? And the sites are not sealed. I mean, it's really not an easy solution. But I think the both ends had to really consider each other, right? The top level climate negotiators and the governments who want to decarbonize, they need to look at the cost of decarbonization, not only within their country, but also overseas, the connection through supply chains, and at the local sites also must consider what is really happening, and just having the oversight of the potential impact like more clearly. I think actually there has been a lot of research also out last year. Patrick Meehan and Dan Sen-Nong from I think he's Kachin Land Research Center researcher have published like a 5-piece series. It's about rare earth mining in Kachin State, and it includes also the briefs on the environmental impact and also the labor conditions and etc. So it's I think a lot of the information has been also been produced, but also been communicated with the local stakeholders through the Kachin Land Research Center.
I mean, I also wonder those far away advocating for a green revolution as a way to make a positive transition in the world, I wonder to what degree they're aware of what is powering their green revolution in these marginalized communities that are just being further burdened. I mean, this is the opposite of what they seem to be aiming and advocating for.
Right. I mean, in many sense, I mean, these connections are like obvious. But then I think the average consumer who's buying Tesla in California probably don't think about this.
Well, the average Tesla buyer has changed a lot in the last year, I think we could also say.
So maybe the Tesla buyers pre-election, so those are the different kind of crowds. But I mean, it's, but also the, I do think that the, like now, the, I think the Europeans also are more interested in having their own supplies, which means that the, it could be also other areas in Europe will be mined for this. And I also really doubt that they will decrease the supply from Myanmar to China. Those are not really also, it's not done because of, you know, the reducing the suffering of Myanmar's most marginalized communities. And also when you think about it, like, a lot of the people who are working in the mines, they were also looking for work because of the coup. So these miners were desperate to find work, and also they do think that this is decent payment, although the money is very a fraction of the wealth that's created, 1.4 billion estimated export in 1 year. So that's a huge amount of money. So yeah, I mean, I do think that there are many connections to be made, and then also our, like, the lack of support for the resistance, and also the military just to go ahead and do the coup d'etat. I think a lot of it just have this impact that's now we're looking at this rare earth mining pits in the northern part of Myanmar. So, yeah.
And I mean, Trump has voiced an interest in rare earth mining as well. Have you come across any signs that his administration would look towards Myanmar?
I think this is a kind of a strange thing, right? That the I don't think so. I think the last thing I heard was that he wants to trade with Ukraine, right? That was the very problematic statement coming from a president from the supposedly the most powerful country in the world. So that's very problematic. But it's also just very much tied to the Chinese processing, because I mean, if you you talked about it during the previous episode, that a lot of the primary processing is done in Myanmar in Kachin State, and then the chemical processing is done in China.
Right.
So China still does all the chemical processing of the Myanmar supply. So it just means that also they have the control of like what happens, because also Myanmar, the producers cannot do the chemical processing. So this just means that they're completely tied to the Chinese supply chain. Mm. And it will go to that pipeline. I think it's a super also interesting. This I say the word this rare earth mineral, but I think the critical mineral is also quite frequently used term, that's very politicized term, that you say this is very critical, and there's something to fight for instead of us looking for different solutions and the thinking about the impact. It's just more competition, more securitizing. Despite this negative impact on the local populations in the mining sites.
Right. Well, I thank you for coming on and talking about this very wide range of issues stretching from Myanmar to China, and then bringing in Korea as well, and covering ranging from natural resources to environmental conservation to looking at exchanges and development and religion between, again, Korea and Burma. Some really interesting connections there.
I think I talked about so many range of issues. This is also very typically me to just, you know, be interested in everything and talking about things in a maybe not in a very structured way. But I mean, just the one thing about this is about justice and peace. Maybe that's maybe something that I didn't talk about, and I mean, because my PhD was in peace and conflict research, and because of that, I have been really interested in also like critically looking at peace, like so what is peace? And a lot of the peace that's understood as just absence of violence, right? So that's so these armed groups stop fighting, then there should be peace. Mm. That's how the peace negotiations are designed, and that's how the peace process is also like primarily focused on. Mm-hmm. But I also think that peace really cannot exist without justice. Mm. So because this, the freedom from want and the freedom from discrimination, also marginalization. Mm. I think a lot of this is not caused by also the singled out armed conflict event or events. So it's, I think it's connected with a much larger problem that any society has. And I think that we all need to kind of find peace in our own life and also in our communities and societies, because I think there are more, I don't want to say the word injustices, but I mean, it just, even if it's not like very outright violence, I think some people are excluded, and because of their identity, because of their upbringing, and I feel like a lot of the times I find the world is becoming more and more polarized and more politicized. And people are looking for something to believe in. That's, I think, also why so many young people prefer autocratic leaders over non-autocratic leaders. So I think it's, I mean, I believe that a lot of the issues are linked to the deficit of peace. But I think peace as justice, I think we can definitely work on that in Myanmar instead of a peace as a, just the absence of violence.
What kind of justice?
It's really the justice for the environment and the justice for the people who are persecuted for a long time. Mm-hmm. Justice for people who cannot have access to land. Mm-hmm. Justice to people who have been discriminated because of their sexual orientation, their identity, mm-hmm. I don't know, their disability. I mean, I think mm-hmm. a lot of this. You say structural violence in a way that is, is kind of a structural conditions that make you less than you could have been. I mean, all these conditions are in Myanmar also because of its military past and the current conflict. Also, all this there's to a degree conservatism, but also like. Just a slow social change. So I think a lot of the change in the future will address this issues or this structural restrictions for people. And I hope that less and less people feel like they experience this.
You mentioned that peace is not just the end of armed groups, but it's also, and I mean, in some ways you could say, you can contrast that with the transition where there wasn't a real, on the part of the Burmese people, there was more of a desire to want to just move ahead and find their opportunities and seek a better day than there was really for accountability or going back to, looking at those who had benefited from their privilege and unjust systems. And that's definitely been something that has changed dramatically this time around is, I don't think that sentiment will be there at all if the military dissolves. I think there's very much a sense that that there needs to be a different way of acknowledging what happened and where we're going to than happened at the onset of the last transition. But then again, it comes to that question of like, what is justice? What does that mean? What does that look like? And certainly there are examples of truth and reconciliation committees that you can find. South Africa, infamously, you reference in Korea. You know, there are many examples that one could look at coming from post-conflict, but as someone who has studied this and is also familiar with the Myanmar context, are there themes or things that you're feeling and you're hearing that that emanate out of what of how the community is looking at what they define as justice and what they want to see as justice coming out of this?
Right. I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. And I mean, I feel like also like during the transition period, there's like speaking of transitional justice was actively discouraged.
Yeah.
Right. So that's right. Very sad. I mean, I think because there are so many people been victimized also. And I mean, even the person who was very much discouraging this, that person was also very imprisoned.
Yeah.
So in a way, like, but then I think that was also like the desire to move forward,
yeah,
instead of looking back.
Right.
Yeah. So maybe, but I mean, maybe she's right that the justice has to wait until later. But then looking at just the, yeah, just is what happened. I think, I don't know. We need to also ask the Burmese people or Myanmar people that, like, what is justice for them? Like, now the most urgent, area of injustice to address or like redress. I mean, I think that needs to be asked. But I think, I mean, we also just know that the most brutal forms of violence has been committed, and like this airstrikes on civilian areas and the targeting schools and residential areas. These are just a daily reminder of the people, to the people, that what kind of situation they're in. And I think, I don't know, yeah, so the, as you mentioned, and I think that is also correct, that there's an opening because of the coup, that people are looking at the things differently because of this injustice, also very immoral action, and also everything became unstable. Their future is now much less promising because the country has much less opportunities. So at the same time, it is an opening. I think it's also just continuously limiting people. And I think just the calling for justice is, I think it is still powerful, and I hope that can help to continue as a fuel to mobilize for the revolution. But I also think that, yeah, I mean, but you're right that the, what is justice to people? What is the most urgent area? What is the most urgent injustice? I think maybe that's the question we need to ask people. So, yeah. So what is it?
And what does it look like?
Right. And then is it in the form of someone going to the Hague in the same prison as the Duterte, or is it something that the more immediate consequences that, yeah, that can happen. So just a very except the one dictator in South Korea, all of them kind of lived very happily until they retired. I don't know. So I think for some people, I mean, there's even like a movie like that's kind of a fictionally assassinating one of the presidents. That came out and was popular. So I mean, yeah, I think it's also difficult to get complete justice on people who committed violence, especially when the transition was peaceful. Then that did not happen in South Korea.
Yeah.
So this is just some historical. So yeah.
And then the distinction between what is the distinction between justice and vengeance as well? You know, these are all dicey things to peer into.
Right. I mean, that's right. I mean, I think those two things they need to be thought differently. You're right.
Yeah. Well, it's a topic that definitely we will be diving into as the conflict changes and progresses, and at that time perhaps you can come to share your thoughts on where it's at and what we're seeing, and I thank you for this very full conversation here.
Thanks for having me, and I don't think I haven't talked to anyone about this type of like divergent topics. I think a lot of people know me like, oh yeah, she does Myanmar research or she does environmental research, and then, oh yeah, but then she happens to be South Korean, but then I don't think I have put together all of that in the one conversation. So it's, this was also like, yeah, a bit of a unique conversation for me. So it's, yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast and make me share about all these different aspects of my research and also my personal life. And
how does it feel to bring all those together?
Yeah, it feels quite good because it feels more wholesome. It makes sense, right? I mean, because I mean, yeah, sometimes I know implicitly why I do it, why I research and why I'm interested in Myanmar, why I'm like, you know, believe in certain values. But yeah, I mean, it's rare that I write everything down on the paper or talk about it in such a lengthy conversation. Right, right. So this has been really useful for me also. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. As with many of our conversations, the one you just heard shines a light on a pressing issue regarding the challenges and complexities now being faced by Myanmar and its people. These stories are powerful and necessary to raise our awareness. But the real value of having our awareness raised comes when it can be translated into some type of positive action. And this is where our pitch comes in. One such action could be supporting us in producing more episodes like this one so that we can continue to air diverse stories and perspectives about what's really happening in Myanmar. This will help raise the awareness and reaching even more listeners who themselves might be propelled to take some type of positive action. As you might imagine, we do have production costs, and it's mainly the generous support of our listeners that enables us to continue this important work in amplifying voices that need to be heard. And so by contributing, you're not just supporting a podcast, you're helping to create space for solutions to emerge, for stories to inspire change, and for awareness to develop into meaningful action. If you believe in the importance of these conversations and want to help us in keeping them going, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Together, we can make sure that these critical conversations continue to inspire action and change. Oh, ba, yara nanda da, yara nanga na, yara nanga da, yara nanga po da, yara nanga no.